Copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
I've been asked to speak about the soul of a leader, and I want to suggest to you when we talk about the soul of a leader, we're saying something very different than talking about leadership ability. There are some who are very capable at leadership skill, but their private lives can be very messed up. And if we read the scripture, we see certainly that was so with David, one of the great kings of Israel, but had very strong difficulties in his private life, horrible father, wasn't able to sometimes control himself morally, was even willing to abuse power and commit murder. We look at his son, Solomon, an extremely capable leader, very, very skilled, but one of the most intemperate people for all of his wisdom in the scriptures. So we're talking about something different than skill here. And the question is, how does a leader manage his soul that he might minimize the risks to those he leads? And this seminar is about developing the soul to become more self-aware and empathetic. And by the way, empathy is an incarnation-like characteristic, because we're entering into the world of the other person, trying to understand them in that world and so forth. Much could be said related to virtue. We could read Aristotle's Ethics about virtue in the life of the leader. You could read 2 Peter chapter 1, verses 1 through 11, where virtually all the characteristics described there are the same characteristics that Aristotle describes in virtue, even uses some of the same words and the same kinds of things that Plato writes about in the Cratylus and so on. I'm not talking about that necessarily, about cultivating virtue. I want to talk about something slightly different. I'm not talking about the kinds of things Plato talks about relative to leaders in the Republic when he talks about the fact that the philosopher kings should be allowed to own nothing to eliminate as much as possible the circumstances that might lead to self-interest. I want to address something slightly different. I want to talk about the soul of the leader that makes us look more like the Lord Jesus. That we were made in the image of Christ, and something horrible happened at the fall. And all of redemptive history is to restore the image of Christ. What does that look like? And what's the process like? And I'd like to address myself to that. Leadership as a gift requires one to be able, I believe, to recruit a team, cast vision, involve the team in that process, define reality, develop infrastructure, set realistic goals, evaluate those goals realistically, resource your workers, and celebrate success. When I first started in ministry, the guy who was a senior pastor at the church where I was a youth pastor said to me one time, "Jerry, a person can accomplish much if he doesn't care who gets the credit." And I used to see this guy in elders' meetings. I knew he had an agenda, but I knew he was very wise. And he would maybe suggest something early on in a meeting of some major thing that needed to be accomplished. And maybe because people feel meetings need to require some discussion, the discussion would go on and what he said would have been left in the back burner. Then all of a sudden, 20, 30 minutes later, somebody would suggest the very thing that he said a moment ago. And he would say, "Wow, Bob's got a good idea there. Hey, let's explore that a little bit. What do you guys think about this idea?" And he would tease out Bob's idea, give Bob the credit for the idea. We would move in that direction. And when success occurred, he would celebrate Bob for his good idea, which also encouraged everybody else on that team to feel like they could have good ideas that could be celebrated too. It was his idea from the beginning. But he got a lot done because he didn't care who got the credit. There was something embedded in his soul that was not self-referential and certainly not utilitarian. John Cotter of Harvard University suggests that the leader who wants to bring about change must follow an 8-step process. They have to establish a sense of urgency, create a guiding coalition, develop a vision and strategy, communicate the change vision, empowering employees for broad-based action, resourcing them, obviously, creating short-term wins, consolidating gains, producing more change, anchoring new approaches in the very culture of the organization. The leadership process is simple enough, and those with leadership skill can pull it off. But without character, skill does not matter as significantly. And consequently, the soul of the leader must be properly matured and developed. If you've read Stephen Covey's book, The Speed of Trust, he says, if you want to develop trust as a leader, you have to have more than just skill. You also have to have character. But you can have all the character in the world. If you don't have skill, you still won't cultivate trust. It needs to be both skill and trust, character and competence. Okay, but when we talk about the soul of the leader, we're not speaking of his competence to lead, but his character, and how is that soul developed? And I would suggest to you, the soul of a leader is corrupted through self-referentialism and utilitarianism. If you're defining reality from your perspective only and not looking at a wider understanding, or even, I would suggest to you in Christian leadership, a transcendent understanding, that self-referentialism is bound to use people, and it will become utilitarian in its approach. C.S. Lewis in The Abolition of Man wrote this, "For the wise men of old, the cardinal problem had been how to conform the soul to reality. And the solution had been knowledge, self-discipline, and virtue. And if this is rejected, Lewis says, by default, we seek to subdue reality to the wishes of men." There's where utility comes into play. The soul conformed to reality is like a life truly lived. Truth is not reality. Truth is when what I say has a reality to support the claim. And a true life is when there's a reality that supports the characteristics involved in that life. So I'll give you an example. Dante, in a book he wrote that most people don't read, we read the Divine Comedy, maybe we read the Vita Nuova, but he wrote the Convivo and he wrote the De Monarchia. And the De Monarchia is a book about leadership. It means of the monarch. And in that book he writes this, taking his lead from Scripture, "Function precedes essence." Function precedes essence. What did he mean by that? Well, in the Scriptures, before God ever makes the luminaries, the sun, the moon, and the stars on day four, he made the light on day one. He made the function before he created the essences to fulfill the function. In other words, purpose is more important than essence. Because the essence is the gifts that God gives us. He gives us for the thing he designed us to do. You're here if you're a leader, then you have an inclination and a proclivity towards leadership. You can worship God that he wired you this way. But now, what is the purpose that he wants for you? And I would suggest before you do any of the big plans in your life, you need to fundamentally understand what God's overarching purpose is for you. And I think it's to look like the Lord Jesus. So in the De Monarchia, when Dante says function precedes essence, we could put it this way too. Creation implies intention. When God creates, just like a potter, when he or she throws the clay on the wheel, they already have an idea in mind what they want to do with that clay. Make a vase, make a cup, make a bowl. Creation implies intention. Now, Charles Williams, a friend of C.S. Lewis's, wrote these poems about Camelot and about the Arthurian legend. And Williams really liked Dante, and he was deeply moved by this point in Dante's De Monarchia. So when he shows King Arthur in this work, King Arthur the Great Leader, he says all of Camelot begins to unravel when he denies function precedes essence. Because Arthur stands up on the ramparts of Camelot and looks out at the kingdom and he asks this question, does the kingdom exist for the king or does the king exist for the kingdom? Reverse the order. The king has the function of existing for the kingdom, to serve them, to build them up, to lead them, and so on. But if all of a sudden the kingdom exists for the king, there's the utilitarianism again. Lewis picks up on this idea too. In most literature, the evil characters will move in this direction. With Lewis, one of the most wicked people in all of his Narnian chronicles is the White Witch of Narnia. We first meet her in The Magician's Nephew, where she's the Queen of Charn. She's so evil and so utilitarian, and she claims that all this kingdom is hers to do with her with it what she wants. And her kingdom mounts up against her in rebellion. And she's learned by magical arts how to say the deplorable word that destroys her kingdom and saves only herself. And at that particular moment, she becomes utterly, utterly utilitarian, and later becomes the White Witch of Narnia. There's an expression of this very concept in the book of Job. And real quick, before I get to the meat and the center of what I want to talk about, let's look at Job for just a second. We meet him in the book of Job, and he is the greatest leader and greatest man in the East. I believe that Job in the Bible is the Jobab, who is the second king of the Edomites, whose good friend in the genealogies is Eliphaz. Eliphaz the Temanite, of course, was one of the three friends who came. Uz was a city in the land of Edom. There's plenty of smoking guns in the scripture to suggest this. There's not enough to prove it, but nevertheless, I think Job was a real person. 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels. Camels represented trade and commerce. He was a very wealthy man. He had 1,000 oxen, 500 yoke of oxen. That meant that he had great farms and ability to produce lots of things. This guy's a great leader. He had 500 she-asses. He had 7 sons and 3 daughters. You all know the story, but when we get to the end of the story and God speaks to him, he speaks to him about some things I want to drive home today. There's 2 speeches that God gives to Job after all of the development of that story. And God says to Job at the beginning of each of the speeches, Job, I want you to gird up your loins like a man, and I will ask you, and you instruct me. It's a ludicrous position God puts himself in. I'm going to sit in the student's chair, student's desk, and you instruct me. And in the first speech, first thing God does is raise his hand. I got a question, teacher. Where were you when I created the universe? I don't remember the Job Universe consulting firm being around at that time. Job, can you take the seas and swaddle them in their boundaries? Swaddle them, diaper the seas. Have you ever spoken to the dawn? Do you know the storehouses of the rain and the snow? Can you keep Pleiades in the hip of Taurus the bull, in its proper courses? Can you manage the heavens? Job, can you feed the lions young? Can you take care of the ostriches, abandoned egg? Job, where were you? Can you? Have you? Will you? Do you? And all of a sudden, Job realizes he's just a pea brain. And any of you who have done good leadership, you know that your task is so complex. You sense in some level your awkwardness. As a matter of fact, I'd suggest to you, you're not awkward someplace in your life, you're just not growing. So consequently, Job gets it in the first speech, but now comes the second speech, and this is the one that's getting to my point. God again begins the speech. Job, gird up your loins like a man, and I will ask you and you instruct me. Will you really annul my judgment that you might be justified? The idea of annulling God's judgment that he might be justified shows that self-referential thing that God wants to remove from him so that he won't be utilitarian. Will you annul my judgment that you might be justified? Okay, Job, let's have a little experiment here. I'm going to let you run the universe. There's leadership for you. I'm going to let you run the universe and let's see what it looks like. You would adorn yourself with eminence and dignity. You would clothe yourself with majesty. And I say to you, Job, and you would take the wicked and you'd destroy them, and you'd take the proud and you'd humble them. And I say to you, Job, your own right hand could save you. There's the self-referentialism again. And the narrative cuts short right at that moment. And then it goes on to saying, forget the universe, you can't even manage a crocodile or a hippopotamus. But listen to what he's saying. And I will say to you, Job, your own right hand could save you. And when the narrative breaks, in the silence, we are allowed to submit the contrast that while Job would save himself at the world's expense, God is willing to save the willing of this world at his own expense. And there is the king for the kingdom. There is a leader who's moving towards not self-referentialism, but the restoration of the image of Christ in him. Now, what does that look like? And how do we go about that? How do we restore the soul in a fallen world? And I'd like to spend most of the rest of our time just giving you two images. And I give you images. I'm not making propositions here. I think we maybe could. I don't know if I'm capable of doing that. I'm not a leader. I don't have a leadership bone in my body. But I think about these things, and I wrestle with them. And they concern me deeply because I think that it's a kind of Christ-likeness that could be applied in any field, but I'm going to seek, even though I'm not of your world and your subculture, I'm going to try and apply it to your world as best I might. So images maybe are better than propositions, because propositions might be too pretentious for me. And the first image I want to give you is basically to suggest our lives are like an old phonograph record. You guys remember what phonograph records were? This life, in this world of CDs and DVDs and so on. Our world's like an old phonograph record. Let me set that up by basically saying all the developmental theorists tell us that there are phases of development. They've been able, through their social science research, even to describe what the general understanding is of how we develop cognitively, Piaget, how we develop psychosocially, Eric Erickson, how we develop morally. And this is Kohlberg, and he had a student named Carol Gilligan. Kohlberg, when he did his research, said a morally developed person, fit for leadership, has a profound sense of justice. And here comes Carol Gilligan, his student, working on her doctorate with him. And she says, I think your study is skewed. Can you imagine a student saying that to a well-renowned and respected professor? But to Kohlberg's credit, he said, make your case. And he listened. And she said, you did all of your testing with men. And I'll bet if you ran women through the case, you might come up with a little bit different result. He said, good point, do it. So Kohlberg had discovered that the morally developed person had a sense of justice. Carol Gilligan found that a morally developed person had a sense of justice and nurture. It doesn't do you a lick of good if I hold you to a standard, but can encourage you and nurture you how to fulfill that standard. You can be a great leader who makes sure that you have made injustice invisible in your area. Just rooted it out. But you could still have bad morale in that place, even though there's no injustice and there's great equity, because you have not been able to nurture your people. You haven't been able to enter into their world and exhibit the Christ-like encouragement that would also be important. So our lives are like an old phonograph record. When we begin our life, somebody sticks a needle in the life and we begin to play out our themes. Invariably, in a fallen and broken world, those records get scratched. And you remember what happened to the old phonograph records when they got scratched? They would skip. They'd go round, go round, go round, go round. Psychologists actually have a phrase for it in development. It's called repetition in search of mastery. Repetition in search of mastery. We find ourselves almost unconsciously engaging in relationships, trying to work through the places where we're stuck. And I would say you might be doing well in 1,000 places in your development. But in a fallen world, my guess is every one of us has 3 to 5 places where the needle just keeps skipping. And so consequently, we look for surrogates with whom we can work these things out. You're driving down the road, somebody cuts you off, you honk the horn at them. That's one thing. But 20 miles down the road, you're still honking the horn, screaming obscenities, honking and yelling and following their bumper. It's not about that person cutting you off. You've brought something to that event, something that longs to be worked out, but you're projecting it. You got somebody that works with you and you say, man, I don't, something wrong with that person. I don't get along. Somebody says, why? So I don't know, bad chemistry, I guess. Bad chemistry is probably an indicator of the place where the record is scratched, and you're looking for a surrogate with whom you can work it out. Almost always in our marriages, this is going to come up, percolate to the surface. And even I think the instruction in Genesis 2, a man shall leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and the two become one flesh. It's not about leaving geographically. It's about learning to leave the generations of past sin, the generations of scratched records that have worked themselves down into our own experience, and that we have the risk of passing on to our own children or even to those around us by virtue of our example. The other thing, too, that we tend to do because of the scratches in the record is we will gravitate towards what I call anesthetizing behaviors. Anesthetizing behaviors. These aren't behaviors that get us better. These are behaviors that get us by. The obvious anesthetizing behaviors: alcohol addiction, drug addiction, sexual addiction, eating disorders, workaholism, the one that sometimes people in your world can be prone to. I think we can have all kinds of interesting ones. I haven't worked with that many Hell's Angel, hard-nosed biker type people, but I've worked with enough of them over the years to see a common characteristic in every one of them I ever met. Once you got close to them, you found out they had a marshmallow heart. And the hard veneer was a kind of anesthetizing behavior to protect what would get to that heart. I know a man who is a leader who creates chaos in his world out there to deflect people's attention from the chaos in his soul. There's a lot of different anesthetizing behaviors. But the one thing that's characteristic of the anesthetizing behaviors, especially if we become Christians, is that in time we develop convictions, and the convictions run contrary to the behaviors. We find ourselves smack dab in the middle of Romans 7. The very thing I desire to do, I don't do, and the thing I find myself doing is something I don't want to do. Paul says, who will help me out? Who will set me free? He says Christ will, but how? This is very important, isn't it? Christ can set us free, but I want to understand how a little bit. But the interesting thing to me is, why is it that if we've got the convictions and we've got these behaviors, and the behaviors are contrary to the convictions, why do we keep drifting back into the behaviors? And I want to suggest to you, it's because our wounds are deeper than our convictions. Our wounds are deeper than our convictions. You can talk to a person until you're blue in the face about things they shouldn't be doing, but the thing that they might be doing is symptomatic of a deeper wound. And until you can get to the deeper wound and find grace in that place, my guess is you'll continue to do the behaviors. So, how do we get better? And I want to give you a story. It's a true story. But it has embedded in it a process for getting better. And this story, in all my years of working with people, it's the third worst story I've ever heard. And it's a true story. It's not my story. And it's about a young boy who, when he's 4 years old, his mother dies in childbirth. I think he's going to have abandonment issues. Social scientists and psychologists tell us if a child experiences trauma before the age of 12, when their sense of self and their self-identity has developed well, they will interpret the tragedy self-referentially. If dad and mom split up and dad leaves, the one son must say, if I would have just done more, maybe dad would have stayed. And they get on a high performance treadmill because they're self-referential. Another child might say, mom left, I wasn't enough to keep her here, I must be dirt. And they get on a very self-destruct pattern. Now, it's interesting to me, C.S. Lewis, when his mother died, he was 9 years old. He was told by well-meaning but unfortunately foolish people at his church, where his grandfather had been pastor, if you pray hard, she'll get better. They shouldn't have given that guarantee. He prayed hard, she got worse. They said, you got to pray harder with more sincerity. He prayed hard with all kinds of sincerity, like a 9-year-old boy who thought his mother's livelihood is dependent upon the sincerity of his prayers, and she died, and he felt responsible for the death. Later, he says, forget that. The God that I was praying to either doesn't matter or doesn't exist, and it set him on the course towards his atheism that years later he would have to come back from. That was something that was rooted in his childhood. Another child might say, you know what? This was so painful. I don't want to ever be in a situation where I am out of control and have to experience that kind of pain. Have you ever met high control people? Usually they're masking some sort of deep pain in their life. Well, there can be lots of different types of behaviors in response to this kind of pain. Matter of fact, you have three kids in one family that all respond to it differently. So this young man, 4 years old, his mother dies. I think he has some abandonment issues. He's raised in a very large family, and it's an extremely abusive family. I'm convinced they weren't sexually abusive, but they were physically and emotionally abusive, and he got the brunt of the grunt. And usually in an abusive family, there can be one child who might be focused out, or one person in the family who might be the focus of the abuse, because again, there's the surrogate with whom the person who has the most power in that family is exhibiting their desire to get past the stuck place. It ends up when he's 17 years old, he's kicked out of the family. He has to find his own support, and he has no visible means of support, but he's a clever guy. He gets work. And at his place of work, he climbs the ladder at his place of work till he's as high as he can get, given his limited circumstances. And it was at that moment, somebody at work filed a sexual harassment charge against him. I'm convinced the guy was innocent, but he went to prison for 7 years over it. My college roommate, on his 6th anniversary, slit his wife's throat and murdered her. And he went to prison for 3.5 years. And this guy, for trumped up charges, goes for 7. It's a true story. Can this guy get better? He's got so many scratches in his record. He does get better. And every one of you know whose story I just told you. Whose story was it? It was Joseph's story in the Bible. All this that I want to tell you is rooted in Scripture. Joseph's mother, Rachel, died in childbirth with Benjamin. He's about 4 years old. His brothers caused him all kinds of havoc. Why were his brothers so horrible to him? You remember, they thought he was the loved son of his father, Jacob. Jacob who played favorites with his boys. And Jacob who should have known better because his father, Isaac, had played favorites with his brother, Esau. And the sins of the parents are visible on the children of the third and fourth generation. Not only that, think about those boys. How would you feel if you lived in a family and it was clear that your father was playing favorites with one of your brothers? How abandoned Simeon must have felt, and Judah must have felt, Naphtali must have felt. The other thing, too, is Joseph didn't ask for those circumstances, and he has to bear the burden of unresolved stuff in his father's life. His father can't be a good leader because he's still got this junk going on in his own life. He has an untethered from the stuff that he experienced in his own family life. So Joseph is sold into slavery, and he climbs the ladder. Potiphar puts him in charge of everything. Potiphar's wife comes on to him, charges him. He was morally circumspect, did the right thing. Potiphar's wife charged him. He ends up in prison. How does he get better? And we are given, I don't know what you call them in your country, if a student doesn't want to read the book, they'll go read what they call cliff notes. And they're summarizing the books. Now they call them Sparks Notes, and they're even shorter than the Cliff Notes. And some students, of course, read the Treasury Comics to find out about the book because they don't even want to read the Sparks Notes. Well, anyway, we do have Sparks Notes or Cliff Notes in Joseph's healing process by virtue of what he named his kids. The first son's name was Manasseh. Do any of you know what Manasseh means? Is there anybody in here that ever knew what Manasseh meant? Anybody? Yeah, you once knew? So what happened? That's exactly what it means, I forgot. I knew we could draw it out of you. Manasseh means I forget. And Joseph says, for God made it possible for me to forget what happened in my father's house. Now we know for a fact that he didn't forget the details. When the brothers come to get grain, he gives them a feast and seats them in chronological order of their birth. He also asked some specific questions about, do they have any other brothers? Because initially it was the 10 and they didn't come with Benjamin. He asks about their father. He asks specific questions, gets information, and he uses that as he sets up a drama of a repetition in search of mastery that will ultimately bring healing to the brothers. He remembers the details. What does he mean by I forget? And I would suggest to you it means he was able to process forgiveness to the place where the pain of the past didn't hold him anymore. C.S. Lewis says, everybody thinks forgiveness is a great idea until they have something to forgive. Let's say you've got some deep scratch in your record and it's starting to materialize in your own thinking and you're entering into the sadness of it finally, because forgiveness is like grief. When my older brother Chester died at 48, this is a man who saved my life when I was a kid from a drowning accident. This was the man who took me to the meeting in college when I heard the gospel and became a Christian. And when he died at 48, I was asked by the family to preach his funeral. And if you think I preached his funeral and walked away and said, I don't have to think about that again, you're crazy. I cried over his death every day for 2 years. When my sister Kathy, the one who introduced me to C.S. Lewis's writings, when her husband Tad died at 50, I was the one asked by the family to preach his funeral. I loved that man. And I didn't walk away from the funeral saying that's over with. Forgiveness is like grief. Something was taken from you. A life without scratches in your record. And you don't just say, I'll forgive you. Or have you ever heard somebody say through clenched teeth, I'll forgive you, but I'll never forget. That's a statement that doesn't recognize the grieving process of forgiveness. It takes time to forgive the deep scratches. So you're going on a long drive. Got a couple hours ahead of you. Going back from the ELF conference. Your mind will gravitate towards unresolved pain often. And rather than going into that room, you want to turn on the radio or something. Anesthetize with sound. Put in a CD. No, sit with it. Sit with it and remember. You'll get angry all over again. Then you'll get sad. Maybe even you'll come to tears. And as you process it, maybe after 2 hours, you bring it to the forgive place. A couple weeks later, you have to revisit it again, and it takes 2 hours again. A couple weeks later, maybe 2 hours again. A couple weeks later, 2 hours again. C.S. Lewis said, when Jesus said, don't forgive seven times, but forgive 70 times seven, maybe it takes 490 attempts to get over one deep wound in our life. Next time it takes an hour and 45 minutes. Next time an hour and a half. Next time 45 minutes. Next time a half hour. Next time 3 hours. You had a relapse. But eventually, the memory and the forgiving become a single act. And at that moment, in a sense, Manasseh's been born in you because it doesn't hold you anymore. If you don't do this work, I guarantee you it will spill out into your relationships, into the world where you are a leader, and it will affect. The toxicity will be there. Anne Lamott, in her book, Traveling Mercy, says, bitterness is like you drinking the rat poison and then waiting for the rat to die. That person could be long removed from your life. But if you're still living in that event and still tethering your heart to that event, its toxicity is destroying you. So Manasseh's born. What's the second child's name? Ephraim. What does Ephraim mean? Be fruitful. Get on with the function that God had wired you for. Function precedes essence. Get on with the function He has wired you for and be fruitful in your area of leadership. Now, when Joseph brings the sons to be blessed by Jacob, he makes sure that Ephraim, his secondborn, is on his right hand, so he'll receive the left hand of Jacob. And that Manasseh, his firstborn, is on his left side, so he'll receive the right hand of Jacob. Jacob crossed his hands. It's the fruitfulness that we need to work towards, and the process of forgiving and forgetting and untethering from past pain is the necessary means to get to that fruitfulness. Okay, so that's one image, the scratch record. Now I want to give you another analogy or another image, if I can. And I'm going to call it three rooms that we all have to pass through in our own development, in our movement towards Christ-likeness. And if there's three, maybe there's 303, but let me just summarize it by three rooms. And the first room I'm going to call the goodwill hunting room. Goodwill hunting room. Did any of you see that movie, Goodwill Hunting? Most of you? If you haven't seen it, let me just rehearse it a little bit with you. The language is despicable. I don't think it's gratuitous because I think it's what people who grew up in that part of Boston would probably talk like. If you hear 9-year-old girls talking like that in a movie like Bad News Bears, that's gratuitous and it's manipulative. But here are these guys. The whole story is basically centered around a guy played by Matt Damon named Will Hunting. He is Einstein-level genius. But he has been horribly abused in his life. Abandoned by his birth family, raised in the foster system, horribly beat up, knife wounds, scars where cigarette butts were put out in his arms. He's bitter, he's angry, but he is a genius. Never went to college, but he could read books, has photographic memory. He's working as a custodian at MIT. And there's this arrogant professor at MIT, and he says to his students, you know what, I've got a problem out there on the board in the hall. If any of you solve it, but I'm sure none of you would be capable of doing this, because I don't think any of you are like me. But if any of you solve it before the semester's over, I can get you a job right out of college with a six-figure income. And the next day, the kids come to class and the problem's solved. The professor says, who did this? And nobody will ante up because the professor will just give them another problem. They won't be able to solve it. And he can't understand it. So the next day, he puts another problem on the board. He says, all right, smarty pants, whoever you are out there, this one took me 6 months to solve. Let's see what you can do now. The gauntlet is thrown down. And the next day they come and it's solved. And all of a sudden they discover it's the night custodian, Will Hunting, who's been doing this. But Will Hunting is a troubled kid. He's got a rap sheet. He's always getting in trouble, arrested for fights and stuff like that. He's on probation and he's violated the probation. It looks like he's going to go to jail. And the professor wants him. The professor wants to hook his wagon to this horse because he sees this guy is Einstein-level genius. The professor wants to use him. Will Hunting is used to people wanting to use him. But the court says you can't have him under your care unless you can find a psychologist who will take him under his or her care and help him through whatever problems he's got. So the professor takes him around to different psychologists from Harvard University, from MIT, the top people in their field. And this guy reads the books of those psychologists, and when he goes in for the appointment, he's got them all ripped apart. And the psychologists back away from him, don't want anything to do with him. Professor's got one last straw, an old college roommate who grew up in South Boston, the same neighborhood where this kid did. But rather than doing anything with his life at Harvard, he goes back to the old neighborhood to pour into the kids in that neighborhood who were like him. He's teaching at a community college. The first time we run into him, he says, the first thing a counselor needs to do is develop trust with his client. So the professor brings Will Hunting to him. The professor's convinced Robin Williams, who plays the counselor, has wasted his life pouring it into these kids in South Boston. And he says, listen, I need you to help me here. I want to know if you would be willing to counsel this kid. He said, how far down was I on your list? He knows the professor. So he meets with Will Hunting and he tells the professor to leave the room. He wants to talk to Will Hunting by himself. Then Will Hunting ties Robin Williams in a knot. The counseling session ends with Robin Williams with his hand on his throat, on Will Hunting, played by Matt Damon's throat. And Matt Damon goes, the counseling session is over. But Robin Williams says, I'm in. I'm in. Bring him back next week. The next week, they bring Will Hunting back. And Robin Williams says, let's go for a walk. They go to Boston Gardens, sit out over the pond. Swan boats are going by. Ducks are lazily swimming. And Robin Williams says to him, you know, you're really smart. I know you're really smart. He said, but everything you know, you got from a book. You've never left Boston. You've read about art, but you've never seen the painting on the Sistine Chapel, the vibrancy of the colors. You have never smelled what it's like to be in that room. You've read about war. Robin Williams' character had been a Vietnam vet. You've read about war, but you've never been in the battle. You don't know what it's like to cradle your best friend as he bleeds to death in your lap. He says, you've read about love. He says, but you don't know what it's like to see the love of your life dying in her bed. And you're sitting next to her in the hospital room, and all the doctors and nurses know that the signs that say visiting hours are over don't apply to you. And Robin Williams says to him, you're an orphan, aren't you? Matt Damon hangs his head and says, yeah. He says, what would you think if I said to you, oh, I know all about that. I read Oliver Twist once. He says, I want to know you, and I want to know that part of you I could never get from a book. There's empathy expressed there, isn't there? Or the desire. So the next week, Will Hunting comes back, and he doesn't say a word the whole counseling session. The professor comes back and says, did you fix him yet? Because he wants to use him. And Robin Williams says, he didn't say a thing the whole time. And the professor says, is that good? Robin Williams says, pretty impressive, actually. Why? Because if Will Hunting doesn't give the psychologist what he wants, will the psychologist abandon him like everybody else in his life has? Or will this guy be different? And all of a sudden, the conversation, as trust is built, begins to happen. And most of that movie is the counseling sessions between the counselor and Will Hunting. And they finally come to this place where Robin Williams brings in the pictures from Will Hunting's file of the knife wounds and the bruises and the bleeding. Matt Damon says, do you know about this? Robin Williams says, yeah, actually I do. And Will Hunting, Matt Damon says, I mean, do you know about this? Have you had this as you? And Robin Williams says, yeah, actually I have. He's very self-aware. He also had been beat up and bruised, but processed to the healing place. So function could precede essence, and he could fulfill his function, pouring his life into others. So Robin Williams looks at Will Hunting, and those of you that have seen the movie know that this is the most poignant moment in the movie. What does he say? It's not your fault. It's not your fault. You do not have to define yourself by the scratches in your record. And as soon as he says it's not your fault, Will Hunting laughs it off. Yeah, I know, which means he doesn't know. That's a defense screen. And he says it again, it's not your fault. Yeah, I know. It's not your fault. I know. And finally, he says one more time, it's not your fault. And the cyst on his soul is lanced, the pus comes out. And he falls weeping into the counselor's arms. And the grieving begins. The forgiving process is able to start. And that's the first room, the Goodwill Hunting room. Oh, I remember that room in my life. I was pastoring a church in Santa Barbara, California. If you believe in Jesus, when you die, you go to Santa Barbara. But if purgatory exists, I worked off all my time while I was there. And this was the biggest church in that town. I was on a trajectory. I felt I was moving someplace. And I got stuck in these circumstances, and I don't know how. And it just all went belly up. I finally went to the board. I inherited 9 full-time pastors. As I looked at their life and their profiles and stuff, I realized, how did they get hired by this church? 6 of them didn't even rise up to the standards in Timothy and Titus on several points. One of them was stealing money from the church. Church had a track record of one pastor years before I got there, a junior high pastor, molested 2 of the boys in the youth group. And at that time, senior pastor told that guy, I'll write you a letter of recommendation. You're going to have to go someplace else. They gave him a big going away party and covered the whole thing up. You talk about sometimes an accusation against the Catholic Church's priest, but here was a guy in that church. I inherited the whole thing. None of this mess had been cleaned up. I finally went to him. I said, I feel like you gave me the order to dig the Suez Canal, and you gave me a spoon to dig it with. That might be good service, but it's not good stewardship of what I should be or what this church should be. But when I left that church, I just fell into a depression. My wife got beat up in that environment too, and she started going for counseling. So she came to me one time and she said, hey, Jerry, and she got the bounce back to her step, and she said, hey, Jerry, why don't you go with me to counseling? I think it would help me if you did. And I said, okay, Claudia, if we can help you. How arrogant was that? And so I go to counseling with her. And all of a sudden, I start inclining into this, and trust was built. And about 9 or 10 months into it, my sister came with me to the counseling session. There was a lot of abuse in my family. No sexual abuse, but physical and emotional abuse. My mother used to wipe poop in my face and leave me at the toilet seat washing it out of my underwear if I messed my pants. Her beatings would be if I had expectation and she didn't want me, she got mad at me for something, she'd take her fist and punch me in the nose. My nose would splatter. I'd be bleeding. It was a lot of just sadness. And you rationalize it, you know, I'm really messed up. I must have deserved this. You're not sitting at the toilet seat washing the poop off your face and saying, wow, mom should get to a therapist and get this stuff figured out. No, you're internalizing it. And my sister came to the counseling sessions and she started talking about some of the stuff and the abuse in that family and the abuse that I'd gotten. I'd been sort of singled out for it. And my sister starts weeping and weeping. And the counselor says, Kathy, why are you weeping? She's 8 years older than me. And she said, I lived in that house and I couldn't do anything about it. And finally, there came the moment, though, in counseling, a few months after that, where I had that it wasn't your fault realization. And I wept and wept and wept. I don't have to define myself by the abuses and the things that get Velcroed to us in a fallen world. I can begin to find my identity in what God thinks about me, who loves me and forgives me and so on. And I wept and wept. 2 weeks. And then a light went on. And this light moves us to the second room. The light that moves us to the second room is a realization, the kind of thing that Richard Rohr, the Catholic pastoral theologian, observed. Pain not transformed is transferred. The way it says it in Scripture, the sins of the parents are visited on the children, third and fourth generation. Or as some have described it, hurt people. Or what Luke 6:40 would indicate, pupil fully trained will be like his teacher. Doesn't mean we know what the teacher knows, but we pick up by contagion that which we experience in our environment. And it could be for good or it could be for bad. And I had to go to the counselor and fearful as all get out, ask the counselor, I have heard that people who have been abused can be abusive. Is that true? She says, it's not always so, but often it is. And I said, then I need to go into that room. And that one is dark. Oh, that one is dark. Where we realize that the things that we were mentored in, we passed on, even though we hated these things done to us, it's possible we could do them to others. I think we were responsible parents. But there, I have an older son, my oldest son, Jeremy. He has 178 IQ. It's hard to raise a kid who's so much smarter than you. And my son, Jeremy, is his own man. He is not in any way affected by peer pressure. I've never seen a person as courageous as him to stand up against peer pressure. But sometimes he's unaware of things that peer pressure should enculturate us to. I haven't seen a one of you picking your boogers and eating them since you've been in here. Somehow the thing that you did in your childhood got leached out at some level. Well, Jeremy still, even in high school, was picking his boogers and eating them. Kids would make fun of him. In junior high, he would get chapped lips and I'd get him some chapstick, but he'd lose the chapstick and keep licking his lips and he'd get that big scab around his face. And it was when I would see his friends making fun of him and marginalizing him, it triggered something in me. I hated to be marginalized by my own mother. And my stuff got projected onto his stuff. And consequently, I'd say, Jeremy, if you do that and those kids make fun of you, it's not good for you. I'm going to spank you. It was never more than spankings. There was no punching and stuff like that. But the spankings got to the place where I would say I was a child abuser. It was horrible. And when I'm in the dark room and looking at my stuff and realizing how it got projected out on my son, oh, the weeping was worse than the weeping in the Good Will Hunting room. And I went to my son. He was 15 at the time. He's 37 now. And I went to him and I said, Jeremy, I want to talk to you about 4 generations of abuse in our family. And I got to the place where I finally got to my own story with him. And I said, I didn't want you to feel rejected and marginalized by your friends. And I didn't even realize it. But I was making you feel marginalized by your own father. Jeremy, I was so wrong. Will you forgive me? Oh, Jeremy, will you forgive me? And we wept and wept for 2 hours. We cried. The next day, I brought it up again. And I said, oh, Jeremy, will you forgive me? Every day for 2 weeks, I brought it up and we cried. And finally, after 2 weeks, he says, Dad, I'm getting it. I'm getting it. I still bring it up with him every once in a while. I remember about a year or two later, I asked him if I could talk about it. And he said, yeah, he gave permission. You wouldn't talk about these things without asking for permission from somebody. And so consequently, he was at this meeting. He was sitting up in the balcony and I was aware of him. And I tell the story, and There are people who are moved by the story. Maybe they hear some of their own story in it. Some came up to talk, but when the meeting was over, I saw him get out of the balcony, and he came down, walked down the center aisle. I was very much aware he was coming while I was talking to this person, and he came and he put his hand on my shoulder, and he just stood there with his hand on my shoulder while we were talking to these other people. I think it was one thing when you acknowledge it privately, but when you can acknowledge it publicly, it must be true. It wasn't his fault. It wasn't his fault. So I remember my daughter, she's got 2 master's degrees and she's got her doctorate in psychology. We drove her to that. And also, she has more degrees in Fahrenheit or Celsius, I think. But nevertheless, when she was doing her doctorate in psychology, every family member was to go to 1 counseling session with her. It was just part of her program. And when I said to my wife, I'm going, I'm just going to acknowledge everything. I think I'm getting secure enough in the love of Jesus to recognize I'm a screwed up person and I'd rather acknowledge it than suppress it. And so we go and she started talking about the bad things that happened in our family. And I said, oh, Alicia, it's true, all that stuff happened. None of that happened to you. It happened to Jeremy. And she said to me, but Dad, through her tears, I lived in that house. And at that moment, I worshiped Jesus that he gave me the experience of having my sister sit in that counseling session and say to the therapist, but I lived at that house. And all of a sudden, I saw what she had experienced. Everybody has their own experience. And I wept. I said, oh, Alicia, forgive me, forgive me, forgive me. What I discovered in the moment of asking forgiveness was in my own heart, I was saying to myself and not to anybody else, if you only knew I was doing the best I knew how, given the tools I had been given. You don't say that to the person you ask forgiveness of because you don't want to confuse your request for their forgiveness. You want to own full responsibility for what you did. But in the moment you say I was doing the best I knew how, that's the threshold to the third room. Because if you were doing the best you knew how, then that meant that the person who hurt you was probably doing the best they knew how, given the tools they were given. And so consequently, forgiveness accelerates backwards and sets you free of all that stuff and allows you to move into the third room, which is the wounded healer room. God's not finished with you with all the pain. Why? Because function precedes essence. And even the conditions of your life, God has allowed to occur that he might prepare you for your work, not just as a leader, but as a wounded healing leader. Go back to Job. So Job is finally restored. But it says in Job 42 that God restored Job when he prayed for his friends. He was a priest to his family at the beginning. He was a leader in his own family. But now God extends the franchise even through the circumstances of his suffering. He's restored when he prays for his friends. And the friends were the ones that hurt him. And God is inviting you to be the wounded healer. You don't have to put up defense if people under your charge who are responsible to you act up or accuse you or say you're a bad leader or something. You can bear the burden of it. You might have to be responsible for them too if they're not doing good work and you need to produce with your ministry or whatever, some outcome. You can evaluate honestly, but you don't have to take offense. You don't have to let that be the guy who's cutting you off and you projecting on that your own unresolved stuff because you're looking still for surrogates. You can be secure enough in the love of Jesus who forgives and gives you the power to forgive so that you're present as a wounded healer with the image of God being restored and being there. So anyway, that's basically what I would have to say to you.